The historical era known as the Enlightenment had its benefits. The world has achieved greater levels of prosperity spread across a greater number of people than at any point in human history. Advances in hygiene and medicine have increased life expectancy and reduced suffering. The Enlightenment following the Reformation broke the religious hegemony that had dominated Europe for more than 1,000 years, leading to increased religious freedom. Of course, there's a flip side to all of those observations, but on the whole, the Enlightenment has done some good. However, there is one casualty of the Enlightenment that I want to focus on today. That's the spiritual. Science has nothing to say about the spiritual because it cannot be observed, quantified, or tested. As the scientific era unfolded, belief in a spiritual realm was recategorized as superstition. This broad skepticism of the spiritual has even led the church to doubt, or in some cases reject, the testimony of Scripture. There is a spiritual realm full of activity beyond our view, and some of it aims to oppose and harm the church. In early March 2020, I was talking with a leader from one of the churches I work with about the situation we were facing. We wrestled with the various unknowns and decisions that church leaders across America faced in those early days. As the conversation unfolded, he told me, "I believe this virus is the work of Satan, and he intends to use it to divide and harm the church." That was in March 2020. And he was right. He was right. Some people who left us in early 2020 haven't been back to our churches since. Facebook arguments have divided brethren. Some churches continue to struggle with internal rifts that have made unity and peace difficult to maintain. Satan sifted us like wheat. And we have not seen the last of him. Satan and his allies employ every tool at their disposal to oppose God's people. Daniel chapter 10 provides a glimpse into these malevolent forces at work. Verse 1 reports that Daniel received a disturbing prophecy. He was so disturbed that he mourned for 3 weeks in prayer and fasting. And bear in mind, this man was likely in his late 80s at this point. At the end of 3 weeks, he was by the Tigris River with a few companions when an angel appeared in a vision before him. The men did not share the vision with Daniel, but were filled with a sense of terror and they fled. What remaining strength Daniel had after 3 weeks of fasting left him and he passed out. The angel rouses and encourages him. "O Daniel, man greatly beloved, understand the words that I speak to you and stand upright, for I have been sent to you." Daniel rises from his prostrate position. He stands up. He's trembling in fear. Verse 12, "Do not fear," the angel assures Daniel, "for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard. And I have come because of your words." What the angel says next is compelling. In verses 13 and 14, the angel pulls back the curtain to reveal spiritual forces vying with one another behind the scenes. During Daniel's 3 weeks of fasting and prayer, the angel battled with a being he calls the prince of the kingdom of Persia. However, he adds in verse 13, "I had been left there alone with the kings of Persia." The New International Version translates that verse, "because I was detained there with the king of Persia." They base this on the Septuagint, which says the chief of the kingdom of the Persians. But the Septuagint is consistent with the beginning of the verse. Daniel chapter 10, verse 13 reveals a spiritual being opposed to God with domain over the kingdom of Persia. This prince of the kingdom of Persia was more powerful than the messenger from God. He could not complete his mission until Michael, one of the chief princes, ended the blockade. Here is the takeaway. While Daniel, a righteous man, prayed and fasted for 3 weeks, pleading with God to understand a disturbing vision, a spiritual battle was happening behind the scenes. The angel elaborates further in chapter 10, verses 20 and 21. He says to Daniel, "Do you know why I have come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince." What the angel's statement seems to imply is that the upcoming struggle between Persia and Greece on earth would include a concurrent fight in the spiritual realm. However, in his struggles against the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece, the angel admits that he will need the help of Michael. "No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince." Happening simultaneously with the human struggle for supremacy is a fight in the spiritual realm. The struggles between great earthly powers manifest in confrontations that are taking place in the spiritual realm. Influential spiritual beings opposed to God work behind the scenes to shape earthly kingdoms. These spiritual forces are so formidable that the angels allied with God sometimes require the help of more powerful beings. Old Testament prophets like Daniel, Elisha, and Samuel fought on the front lines of a war waged in both the material and the spiritual realms. The power struggles we see on earth are merely manifestations of battles happening behind the scenes. After the Babylonian captivity, we see Persia and Greece not only vying for power, but also being used as tools to oppose God's divine purpose. Although Cyrus the Great fulfilled the prophecy in Isaiah by sending 50,000 Jews back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple, the project was delayed by the Samaritans. The Samaritans held up the rebuilding of the temple. Under the reign of Xerxes, the courtier Haman nearly orchestrated a genocide against the Jewish people. Nehemiah faced increasingly strong opposition from the Samaritans while rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, despite having the blessings of Artaxerxes. In the 4 centuries that followed Daniel, Israel would be at times at the center for struggle for power in the Middle East. And at times, those forces would oppose God's people and pursue their annihilation. So going back to Daniel chapter 10, verse 20, the angel says to Daniel, "And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come, but I tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince." The return to Jerusalem would not be easy. The Jews would face opposition, oppression, and potential genocide. The princes of Persia and Greece, spiritual powers opposed to God's people and his prerogative, helped influence and orchestrate these oppositional forces. As the Jews faced earthly powers, this angel would ally with Michael to confront the princes of Persia and Greece in the spiritual realm. And by implication, we can conclude if those two angelic beings had not been involved, the temple in Jerusalem might still lie in ruins, with the Jewish people wiped out either by the Persians or the Greeks. The Bible shows a consistent pattern. Behind human thrones and city walls, spiritual powers collide. However, this conflict does not occur solely in the struggles between great powers. Moses and Paul both describe idolatry as the worship of demons. Paul predicted the apostasy would be fueled by doctrines of demons. John warned the church not to accept all prophets, but to test the spirits whether they were from God. We tend to think of such threats in terms of false teaching, that we deal with perversions of the gospel or the word of God. But consider what Paul dealt with as he preached the gospel among the Gentiles. Paul contended with Epicurean and Stoic philosophers in Athens. To the Corinthians, he contrasted the wisdom of God with the wisdom of the world. A short time later, as he wrote to the churches in Rome, Paul revealed how Gentile cultures declined, starting with a darkening of the mind and futile thinking. He warned the Colossians of the dangers of human philosophy that flowed from the basic principles of the world. Our battle against the spiritual forces of darkness encompasses more than just perversions of the gospel. To be clear, human philosophy and the ideologies it produces can have demonic origins and influences. Before he wrote the Communist Manifesto with Friedrich Engels, Karl Marx was an aspiring playwright and poet. Robert Paine, a highly respected British professor of English literature and drama, wrote a definitive biography of Marx. In it he writes, quote, "Marx was devoted to poetry. Poetry was in his blood, and he could no more think of living without poetry than living without his vision of a communist world." This was especially true when Marx was a young man. Paine writes, "The young Marx was passionately devoted to poetry and took himself very seriously as a poet. Poetry was the love of his life, the safe refuge from all the turmoils of his revolutionary existence." These earlier works of Marx show a very disturbing side of this aspiring intellectual. In January 1841, 7 years before the publication of the Communist Manifesto, a Berlin literary magazine published a poem by Marx entitled The Player. The poem imagines a violinist who, in a delirious frenzy, summons up the powers of darkness with his furious strings. No, this isn't The Devil Went Down to Georgia, just in case you were wondering. This is long before that. But one passage from this poem is very striking. I'm going to quote at length, but it's a disturbing poem. Here's what Marx wrote. "Look now, my blood-dark sword shall stab unerringly within thy soul. God neither knows nor honors art. The hellish vapors rise and fill the brain. Till I go mad and my heart is utterly changed. See the sword. The prince of darkness sold it to me. For he beats the time and gives the signs. Ever more boldly I play the dance of death. I must play darkly. I must play lightly until my heart and my violin burst. The player strikes up on the violin, his blonde hair falling down. He wears a sword at his side and a wide wrinkled gown." I'm sure it was better in the German, but that's the English translation. Robert Payne, the aforementioned biographer of Marx, interpreted this poem as, quote, "a pact with the devil, consecrated by the purchase of the blood-dark sword which kills with unerring aim." The Player is just one of many works of literature that demonstrate Marx's dangerous obsession with the demonic. In a different poem from 1837, Marx wrote, quote, "Thus heaven I forfeited, I know it full well. My soul, once true to God, is chosen for hell." When the first biographer of Karl Marx, a man by the name of Franz Mehring, discovered these early poems, he urged Marx's daughter Eleanor to hide those works, lest they tarnish Marx's public image. Another biographer by the name of Paul Johnson commented about Marx, "Savagery is a characteristic note of his verse, together with the intense pessimism of the human condition, hatred, a fascination with corruption and violence, suicide pacts, and pacts with the devil." This passion for the Prince of Darkness stems from Marx's admiration for one of Western literature's most celebrated works. Marx was obsessed with Goethe's Faust. This work influenced Marx more than any other piece of literature. The poem is about a dissatisfied scholar, Faust, who makes a wager with the devil, who Goethe calls Mephistopheles. He makes this wager to find a moment of fulfillment. Blessed with a retentive memory, Marx committed large sections of Faust to memory, especially the long speeches from Mephistopheles. Robert Payne writes, "Goethe's Faust was his Bible, the one book which he regarded with unreserved admiration, and he liked to roar out the verses of Mephistopheles. He had the devil's view of the world and the devil's malignity. Even his father could see it." In a letter written in March 1837, Heinrich Marx pleaded with his son, "Is your heart in accord with your head, with your talents? Has it room for the earthly but gentler sentiments which in this vale of sorrows are so essentially consoling for a man of feeling? And since that heart is obviously animated and governed by a demon, not granted to all men, is that demon heavenly or Faustian?" One line from Mephistopheles in Faust struck a chord with Marx more than any other. "Everything that exists deserves to perish." In private letters, Marx called for the ruthless criticism of all that exists. In the manifesto, Marx and Engels state that communism seeks to, quote, "abolish the present state of things," by which they mean the abolition of eternal truths, all religions, and all morality. At the close of the manifesto, Marx and Engels call for the, quote, "forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions." When asked to sum up communism, Marx stated it succinctly. "The theory of communists may be summed up in the single sentence, abolition of private property." The words of Mephistopheles, "everything that exists deserves to perish," influenced Marx's economic thought, helping form the core ideals of communism. Marx was a notoriously lazy man. He depended entirely upon the charity of his family and friends. Frederick Engels' father made a lot of money during the early Industrial Revolution in England. I know, go figure, you know, capitalist makes the guy rich, and yeah, anyways, thus it goes. This put Engels in a position to be Marx's benefactor. But it was a one-way street. When Ingalls wrote of his broken heart over the death of his mistress, Marx responded with two lines of surprise at her death and dismay, and 31 lines about his financial troubles. I'm really sorry she died, but let me tell you how bad my life is. His father, his mother, and his extended family all record similar experiences with Karl Marx. In 1849, his landlord evicted him and his family. We've uncovered a Prussian police report that offered the following testimony. Washing, grooming, and changing his linens are things he does rarely, and he likes to get drunk. He has no fixed times for going to sleep or waking up. As for the family apartment, the report says this. Everything is broken down. In a word, everything is topsy-turvy. To set down becomes a thoroughly dangerous business. Because he refused to wash on a daily basis, Marx was persistently afflicted with boils, the extent of which is not polite to share in public. Aristotle wisely observed that men start revolutionary changes for reasons connected with their personal life. I think that's a profound insight. And it's certainly true with Marx. Here is a man who had a dangerous fascination with the satanic. This inspired Marx in his earlier poems and plays. The central theme of his manifesto emerged from an ideal expressed by a demonic character imagined by a herald of German Enlightenment philosophy. Marx wrecked his personal life through laziness, selfishness, and entitlement. And I didn't even take the time to talk about the heartbreaking stories about his family. He had 6 children. 4 of them preceded him in death. And after he died, the last 2 took their own lives. A horrific story. As the kids say, Karl Marx was a hot mess. He really was. He was a disaster. And the ideology he helped create and the disciples that it inspired went to war against religion. Marx famously described religion as the opium of masses. His father, Heinrich Marx, was a Jew who converted to Protestantism and raised his family in the Lutheran faith. Karl gradually lost his faith during his college years, and one needs only to read his dissertation to see that Marx had fully abandoned his faith by 1841 and had become an outspoken atheist. As I mentioned a moment ago, Engels and Marx called for the elimination of all religions in the Communist Manifesto. Communism begins where atheism begins, declared Marx. I had to double check that quote there. I thought I was reading it wrong, but that's right. He said, communism begins where atheism begins. Marx viewed communism as antithetical to religion, and thus religion must be eliminated. The Russian Bolsheviks, led by Vladimir Lenin, took this message to heart. For the better part of 1,000 years, the Russian Orthodox Church had stood the test of time and was closely entwined with Russian culture and the aristocracy. The Orthodox faith alone in Russia had 40,000 churches and some 150,000 ordained ministers spanning the 12 Russian time zones. On the eve of the Bolshevik Revolution, 657 churches stood in Moscow alone. According to official Soviet statistics, only 100 to 150 remained in 1976. The Orthodox Patriarchy reports only 46 of those churches held services by the mid-1970s. They set out to destroy religion, and they just about did it. The Bolsheviks placed Russian churches in their crosshairs. In May 1909, Vladimir Lenin wrote, "Marxism is materialism. As such, it is relentlessly hostile to religion. We must combat religion. That is the ABC of all materialism and consequently of Marxism. The combating of religion cannot be confined to abstract ideological preaching, and it must not be reduced to such preaching. It must be linked up with the concrete practice of the class movement, which aims at eliminating the social roots of religion. Beyond the Russian Orthodox Church, virtually every religious community experienced prohibition, property confiscation, arrests, deportations, and surveillance under Soviet rule. Just in case you think I'm giving the Bolsheviks a bad rap, you should read what they had to say as they coveted all the riches of the Russian Orthodox Church and how all those leaders got incredibly wealthy all of a sudden when they raided those churches. Without question, the Soviet system went to war against God. And as religion retreated, the Communist Party filled the void. Truth became whatever the party decided to be true. Leon Trotsky wrote, "Clearly the party is always right. We can only be right with and by the party." Weddings, baptisms, and funerals were converted into secular ceremonies. They called them red weddings, red baptisms, and red funerals. At red baptisms, infants were given secular godparents who would ensure the child became a worthy builder of communism. Young mothers would declare, "The child belongs to me only physically. For his spiritual upbringing, I entrust him to society." Soviet communism first undermined and then it replaced religion. In Matthew chapter 7, verses 15 through 20, Jesus teaches us to recognize false prophets and teachers by the fruit they bear. The destructive results of Marxism cannot be denied. The creator of communism was obsessed with the demonic. He eschewed religion. He lived an absolutely dissolute life. Communism preaches materialism, that man lives by bread alone. Contrary to what progressive theologians claim, communism is fundamentally incompatible with Christianity. Communism advocates atheism and it opposes any religion that does not serve the party. James asks, "Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs?" People want to bring communism and Christianity together. As one of our national candidates for office suggested last year, you know, some of us just think socialism is being a good neighbor. Vladimir Lenin said socialism is the gateway drug into communism. That's how they viewed it. And that's the communist aim. One step closer to what we're trying to achieve. Communism and Christianity are incompatible. I look at the fruit of communism and conclude this is a demonic, anti-Christ ideology. There's just no question in my mind about that. So my topic is requirements for defense against the spiritual forces of darkness, right? So how do we defend? How do we defend ourselves against such forces? I like to go to 1 Peter chapter 5, and that's where we'll spend the rest of our time this afternoon. In 1 Peter chapter 5, verses 6 through 10, Peter offers some crucial guidance. And the reason I picked this passage is because Peter, in verse 8, highlights that Satan is a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. So let's look at this passage and the context surrounding that idea and see what we can discern about fighting against the spiritual forces of darkness. In verse 9, Peter says, "Your brotherhood is experiencing the same kinds of sufferings throughout the world." Here's a comforting message. We're not alone. We're not the only ones up against these spiritual forces of darkness. Paul reminded the church at Thessalonica, who had converted to Christ under great duress, that their brethren in Judea had gone through similar struggles. And it's not just human compatriots that stand with us in the struggle. Remember, a Syrian army surrounded Elisha and his servant. But that human army was itself surrounded by an angelic army. Outside the beleaguered walls of Jerusalem in the days of Hezekiah, an angel of the Lord slew 185,000 Assyrians in one night. In the armor of God, Paul says victory is assured when we rely on God's power. Be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 10. We put on the armor of God, verses 11 and 13. Brethren, we do not stand alone. We have one another, and we have friends in places we cannot see. In verse number 9, Peter also says to resist Satan, firm in your faith. The battle we fight is a defensive battle. The word resist in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 9 is from the same Greek word as withstand in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 13. Paul says there, put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. To resist and to withstand, these are the same words, same idea. And I notice in the armor of God passage, that's what I'll call it, four times in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 10 through 13, four times Paul says to stand. We do not retreat. We do not advance. We stand. Or to put it another way, we're defending territory that's already been conquered, brethren. Jesus Christ has won the victory. All we have to do is stand. Jesus disarmed the principalities and powers, making a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it, in the cross. Colossians chapter 2, verse 15. The victory, brethren, has already been achieved. All we need to do is stand, stand firm, remain steadfast, unmovable, and defend the territory Christ has already won. Here's something else Peter says. In verse 8, he advises us to be sober-minded. The Greeks used this word for literal sobriety, not drunk or intoxicated. But both Peter and Paul utilize it in a figurative sense. They mean clear thinking, dispassionate, or temperate. Those who are sober-minded are not overcome by anxieties over perceived threats, but face them with sound thinking and sober judgment. Another way of saying this is, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. It's the attitude Peter teaches in chapter 3, verse 13. And who is he who will harm you if you become followers of what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. And do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. Peter is telling us, do not be afraid, be sober-minded. Although Paul uses a different Greek word, he expresses the same idea over in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. For God gave us a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control. Some of our translations have done us a bit of a disservice with that word fear. It's not that it's a mistranslation per se, but it's not the best one that's available. The word fear is more accurately translated as timidity or cowardice. The New American Standard does a better job with this verse. For God has not given us a spirit of timidity. Fear, anxiety, or timidity, or cowardice, these do not come from God. The Spirit of God produces a sound mind, a sober mind, a mind that is under control. God will give us the courage that we need. He says to Ezekiel, "Behold, I have made your face strong against their faces and your forehead strong against their foreheads. Like adamant stone, harder than flint, I have made your forehead. Do not be afraid of them, nor be dismayed at their looks, though they are a rebellious house." Ezekiel chapter 3, verses 7 through 9. We need courage to overcome the hosts of wickedness. And if we trust in God, He will supply it. Prayer. Prayer defends us against spiritual forces of darkness. In verse 7, back in 1 Peter chapter 5, Peter says, "Cast all your anxieties on Him, because He cares for you." When facing opposition, Moses fell prostrate before God, intervening on behalf of the people, including at least two occasions when he fasted and prayed for 40 days. Elisha prayed for God to open his servant's eyes and to close the eyes of the Syrian army. During Daniel's 3 weeks of fasting and prayer, a battle between angelic and demonic forces unfolded in the spiritual realm. As Peter prepared the churches to confront persecution, death, and the return of the Lord, he says in chapter 4, verse 7, "But the end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be serious and watchful in your prayers." While every piece of the Christian armor is vital, you'll notice at the end of the description, Paul says, "Praying with all prayer and supplication with thanksgiving," right? While every piece of the Christian armor is vital, we cannot contend with the principalities and powers in the heavenly places without prayer. The older I get, the more I realize that. Not to beat a dead horse, this has been covered a few different times this weekend, but we'll come back to it one more time. Humility. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6. "Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time." If you want to overcome, you have to be humble. In the days of Hezekiah, the Assyrian army conquered every major city of Judah. Only Jerusalem remained, and it was under siege. Rabshakeh, messenger from the king of Assyria, boasted that his gods had conquered the gods of Hamath, Arpad, Sepharvaim, Hena, Iva, and Samaria. And he asked Hezekiah, "What leads Jerusalem to believe their God will be any different?" Hezekiah received a proud, defiant letter from Rabshakeh, from Sennacherib. And he did the only thing he could do. Jerusalem was besieged. Its army was no match for the might of the Assyrians. Judah had no earthly allies. No one was coming to their rescue. If Hezekiah wanted to rescue Judah from the brink of disaster, the only thing he could do was take this letter to the house of the Lord, humble himself, and call upon the name of the Lord. And that's what he did. God responded through the prophet Isaiah, and as I mentioned a moment ago, that night, an angel of death slew 185,000 Assyrians outside the walls of Jerusalem. Sennacherib retreated to his capital at Nineveh, and not long after, his sons assassinated him, and Esarhaddon, his son, took his place. God delivered Judah from the edge of ruin because her king humbled himself under the mighty hand of God. The battle really does belong to the Lord. It's not ours to win. As I close, I want to leave you with passage, Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 through 9. In Revelation chapter 12, verses 7 through 9, John sees a vision of Michael leading the hosts of heaven against the dragon, Satan, and his angels. Speaking broadly, I believe Revelation 12 dramatizes the manifestation of Satan, the manifestation of Christ, and Satan's attempts to thwart his appearance, his ministry, and his kingdom. verses 7 through 9 seem to parallel Christ's redemptive work at the cross. They reveal that while Jesus suffered for our sins on the cross, spiritual forces vied for supremacy behind the scenes. The hosts of heaven led by Michael prevailed and cast Satan from heaven. Jesus spoke of this as he approached his crucifixion in John chapter 12, verse 31. He revealed, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out." Following the crucifixion of Jesus, Satan would no longer be granted an audience to accuse God's people, as he did with Job or the high priest Joshua in Zechariah chapter 3. Jesus at the cross revoked Satan's audience with God. As the voice of heaven declares in Revelation chapter 12, verse 10, "The accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down." Satan, the accuser, cannot level an accusation against the people of God. This is why Paul asks in Romans chapter 8, verse 33, "Who shall bring a charge against God's elect? It is God who justifies. Who is he who condemns? It is Christ who died, and furthermore is also risen, who is even at the right hand of God, who also makes intercession for us." As I said a moment ago, the victory has been won. We are more than conquerors through him who loved us. And if you want to be a part of that victory this afternoon, we invite you to take advantage of this moment. Come forward. Confess your belief that Jesus is the Son of God. Pledge from this moment forward to turn your life around and to follow after him. Submit to his command by being united with his death, burial, and resurrection in the waters of baptism. If we can help you take part in the victory that Jesus secures, please come forward as we stand and sing number 229 in the Sacred Selections.